It's good to see you all out tonight. Thank you for coming. I want to say, first of all, that I really appreciated those of you that sought me out and made comments about how the Lord used his word in your life this week from Ecclesiastes. That is encouraging to any speaker. And so I strongly challenge you to make that a regular discipline of yours in the life of the church. Couple of things I want to say to start out with. One, I do intend to... For those of you who weren't here last week, I'm sorry, but I do intend probably this week to actually watch The Truman Show, okay? Paul actually asked me, he said, how did you come up with that without having seen it? And I honestly can't remember, okay? That illustration came to me years and years ago, and I just can't remember how I came to it, but I will do my best to probably make that happen this week. So I'm looking forward to that. And then the last thing I want to say is, way of introduction is, last week you know that as I was preparing to kind of finalize this and come over here on Sunday, I had some hevel in my life where our car broke down. And that persisted throughout the entire week. It could not be fixed. And so we've been under that hevel this week. But good news, it was actually fixed this morning. And so I'll be able to pick that up tomorrow. So we're thankful for that. Did you have any hevel this week? Yes? Did the hevel come to your mind this week when something happened? I know it did for me a lot. I turned to Rachel and I said, well, there's some more hevel, you know, and so it was a good reminder for me. I hope it was for you. I'd like to go back briefly tonight. We'll do a little bit of review just because we do have to build on what we talked about last time. But also I'd like to go back and do what I would have wanted to do the first time and just talk a little bit about Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament, specifically in the wisdom books, and what place it has in those books. The wisdom books of the Old Testament are three. They are Proverbs, Job, and Ecclesiastes. In Proverbs, we learn that God's world is ordered. Primarily, Proverbs uses proverbial statements that describe how life consistently works. If you do A, then B will happen. Okay, for example, Proverbs 13:21 says, disaster pursues sinners, but the righteous are rewarded with good. If you do this, this happens. If you do this, this happens. That is kind of standard fare for Proverbs. The wise man or woman is the one who orders his life according to the order of God's world because he or she fears the Lord. The wise lives in God's world, God's way. What Proverbs does not emphasize are the times when these proverbs or maxims do not explain what we see in life under the sun. Proverbs is not blind to this. It is not ignorant of these times, but it does not emphasize these times. And so for help with those times in our lives, when we look at life and we say, this looks like disorder. This looks like, it doesn't make any sense. Okay. For those times, we must turn to two other books, Job and Ecclesiastes. So again, another example. In Proverbs, we read, disaster pursues sinners, but the righteous are rewarded with good. Then we come over to Ecclesiastes and we read something like this. There is a vanity that takes place on earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked, and there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I said that this also is hevel. Okay. Now on the surface, those two statements appear contradictory. Proverbs says, disaster pursues sinners, the righteous are rewarded with good. Ecclesiastes says, I can give you tons of examples when that's not true. The problem is, the standard proverb only describes what normally happens, okay? There are going to be exceptions to that. We know this, okay? In fact, we have this built into our own culture, okay? It could be that this Thursday, as the women and men are gathered in the kitchen cooking a Thanksgiving dinner, someone, because there'll be like 10 people in there, and someone will say, this proverb, they will say, what? Too many cooks spoil the soup or the pot or the broth. And the meaning there will be, everyone get out. because I can't get this done with all of you working in here. Okay. But it could also be that in another house, there's a woman perhaps laboring alone, okay, to prepare this meal. And what does she say? She says, many hands make what? Light work. Okay? So the nature of Proverbs are such that they are general descriptions of how life normally or consistently works, but they're going to be exceptions to that. And we have tons of things like that. I mean, we say bigger the better, right? But we also say what? The best things come in small packages. Okay, so we have tons of these. We understand this. The book of Proverbs focuses primarily on how life consistently works. Ecclesiastes and Job do not contradict, correct, or disprove Proverbs. They complement it. They focus more on the times when the Proverbs do not explain life under the sun, and thus life appears disordered. Altogether, these books give us a more complete understanding of how to live wisely or how to live in God's world, God's way. Ecclesiastes and Job are also written from different perspectives within themselves, okay, or between themselves. My good friend Jeremy Farmer, I owe him this observation. He has observed that Job considers life from the bottom. Okay? He has lost everything. He has nothing. Ecclesiastes, on the other hand, Solomon, he considers life where? From the top. He has everything. And so from these opposite perspectives and complementary perspectives, Job and Solomon wrestle with the apparent disorder of life. And from these men, God's people are to learn how to live in God's world, a place of order, but also a place where the unexpected and inexplicable are common, a place where there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked, and there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. And so these three books together are designed to work together in helping us understand how to live in a world of Hevel. Now, a little more review before we go farther. Last time we were together, we went back to the very beginning, right? When everything was very good, when God's people were in God's place under God's rule, God had commissioned his people to rule over creation. Adam sinned, and so God announced changes to the creation. Changes that would frustrate Adam and Eve's attempts to master life under the sun. Life under the sun would now be full of thorns and thistles, what Solomon calls Hevel. Solomon looks at life under the sun, and he sees nothing, or I shouldn't say nothing, he says he sees Hevel everywhere. Hevel of Hevels, all is Hevel, he says. Hevel, for those of you who weren't here last week, is the Hebrew word that is commonly translated vanity, meaningless, or temporary. But as we said last week, I believe, and it's not just me, because that probably wouldn't be enough, but I believe that it's better translated frustrating enigma. An enigma is something that perplexes and resists our attempts to master it, whether it is in our ability to understand it or our ability to control it. And so Solomon would say that trying to master life under the sun is like trying to catch the wind. It's not possible. It's like striving for wind. So obviously God changed the world in this way because God's people rebelled against his rule. But Ecclesiastes goes farther, and this is where we spent our time last Sunday night. In Ecclesiastes, we learn that God has given to humanity a sense that there is coherence and meaningful progression to all of the many and varied times of life under the sun. We recognize that this all fits together somehow. God has put that sense into us. He hasn't put it into the animals. You've never driven down the road, looked to the side, and seen a bear banging his head on the tree saying, I just don't understand. It's never happened, okay? It's not out there. God gave it to humanity. We know that there is coherence, but we can't figure it out from beginning to end. Life under the sun frustrates all of our attempts to master it. We want to know. We try and try to understand, and it's like trying to catch the wind. It's Hevel. It's a frustrating enigma. It is our God-given, unhappy preoccupation to be always pursuing but never achieving full understanding of all that God is doing in life under the sun. So we ask the question, why would God design life to be this way? Why would God do that to us and give us this unhappy preoccupation? The answer is not just because Adam and Eve sinned, although that is a right answer. The answer is also that we might fear God. God uses the hevel of life under the sun to teach us that we are not in control, and so we cannot achieve ultimate gain by our efforts. The right response to the hevel of life under the sun is not to respond as Adam and Eve did and assert that they know the world better than the one who made it, and thus live as if he is not the king. The right response is to fear God. And so what does that look like? And that's what I want to answer this week. Okay, what does it look like to fear God? Now, my answer tonight is not going to be comprehensive, in that I'm going to give you everything it looks like to fear God. But I want to look at two things that Ecclesiastes emphasizes as characteristic of the person who fears God. Two things that are characteristic of the person who fears God. Now, each of these things, each of these facets of the God-fearing life come with a tension that we have to deal with. Okay, something that initially we're like, how does that work? And then we have to work through it. So that's what I want to do with you tonight. The first one is this. The first characteristic of the person who fears God is that he pursues after wisdom. He pursues after wisdom, he or she. To pursue wisdom rightly, we must understand the tension between life's consistency and its unpredictability. Okay? Life is both consistent and unpredictable. Okay, there's a tension there. How does that work? Okay? And if we're going to pursue wisdom rightly, we have to understand how those two things can be true at the same time. So, let's dive in. After what we covered last time and just reviewed, if someone asked you, what is Ecclesiastes all about? Someone might say this, quote, Ecclesiastes confronts us with the fact that hevel makes life under the sun completely unpredictable from our limited perspective, and so we need to fear the Lord. Sounds pretty good. The problem is that this statement is not an accurate representation of Ecclesiastes' message. Not just because it leaves out some important elements, but because it actually misrepresents not only Ecclesiastes, but also life itself. Is life under the sun completely unpredictable from our perspective? Okay. We want to be careful that in our appreciation for, I can't understand, so I trust the Lord, that we don't go too far and overstate the kind of hevel that we live in, or kind of world that we live in. Is life under the sun completely unpredictable from our perspective? So the answer to this question, the first thing I want to show us is this, is that Solomon, as he writes this book, encourages us to pursue wisdom. And we'll see why that's important in a second. But I want to walk you through the text quickly here. If you want to turn with me, you can, but we're going to go rapidly from text to text, just showing how Solomon encourages us, exhorts us to pursue wisdom. And we'll talk about why that's important. So Ecclesiastes 2:13, what does Solomon say? He says, then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. Ecclesiastes 2:13. So there's a value in wisdom right there. Ecclesiastes 4:13. We read this, better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. He's making a value statement here. He's saying it's better to be wise than to be a fool. So he's encouraging us toward wisdom. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 5. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 5. It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. Again, there's a superiority to wisdom. Look down to verse 12 of chapter 7. It says, for the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, and the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Look at chapter 9, verse 16. Chapter 9, verse 16. Solomon says, but I say that wisdom is better than might. Though the poor man's wisdom is despised and his words are not heard, that's hevel, The words of the wise heard in quiet are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. There's a lot in those couple of verses, but what I want you to see is that wisdom is to be pursued. It is valuable. It is superior. It is a good thing to pursue. Lastly, chapter 10, verse 10. If the iron is blunt and one does not sharpen the edge, he must use more strength. But wisdom helps one to succeed. Okay. So, clearly throughout the book, Solomon would have us pursue after wisdom. Okay. Both here and in Proverbs, same thing, pursue after wisdom. If life is completely unpredictable, how do you explain Solomon's encouragement, his exhortation to pursue after wisdom? You can't. Because foundational to wisdom in the Old Testament is the reality that there is observable consistency to life under the sun. The standard proverb is a statement that captures or describes the way that life normally happens, the order of life, the consistency of it. We looked at one of these before, Proverbs 10:4, a slack hand causes poverty, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. Is that always the case? Yes or no? Is it always the case that a slack hand causes poverty? Have you ever known someone who was lazy that was rich? Yes, we all have. So this proverb, in one sense, is not always true. Meaning, it's not always the case. It doesn't always apply. But it is the way that life normally or consistently happens. There is a way that life normally works. Or to say it better, there is a way that God normally rules his world. And Proverbs picks up on that. Wisdom picks up on that. Wisdom depends upon that. The wise man, therefore, is not someone who can predict the future. Rather, the wise man understands how God normally rules over his world, and he applies that knowledge to the way that he lives, striving to live in God's world, God's way. And there will be times when the wise man is blindsided by something. It comes out of nowhere. He did not see this coming. But that doesn't mean that God is now chaotic and that the world is full of chaos. It's a reminder that though we want to understand life from the beginning to the end, God has revealed only some of his plan. He hasn't told us everything. Now, if you'll humor me for a second, I have an illustration. There we go. When I showed Andrew my PowerPoint slide, he was like, wow, it just didn't like what you put in there. But that is actually the slide, okay? That is it. So I have to give credit to my brother. He and I, mainly him, it was his idea that birthed this illustration. He was working with his child on some SAT type tests. You remember those in grade school? Okay, so I'm going to ask you to look at that, and I'm going to ask you, what's next? Okay? So what comes next in the pattern? Anybody? Square. Okay, let's see. Great, you get a square. Awesome. Now, next question is, what comes after that? Okay, you're wrong. It's not a circle. It's actually a triangle. Okay. Now, how could that be a triangle? How could the next thing in the sequence, maybe you're thinking, Phil, you didn't do well at those tests, did you? Yeah. How could the next item in the series be a triangle? It's obviously got to be a circle. Well, it only has to be a circle if what I see up here fully represents the pattern. Catch that? It only has to be a circle if what I see up here fully represents the whole pattern. Okay? But if we could take a look at the whole pattern, we'd see that had we known everything, we'd have been like, oh, it's got to be a triangle. Okay? We would have been like, that makes perfect sense. Okay? So I want you to see two things here in this illustration. The observable consistency of God's rule over the world makes it possible for us to look at life, perhaps at a decision, and say, this is what we should do because of the way that God rules his world. And life will often move forward as we expect. We predicted a square was next on the first one, right? And we were right, weren't we? Okay? That happens often. Okay? That's the fact that can happen in life, that's why wisdom is possible. You can look at life Look at the way God rules his world and say, you know what? Because of the way God normally rules his world, this is what the kind of thing that should happen next in this situation. Okay? And you can act upon that and pattern your life around that. That's what Proverbs majors on. But there will also be times when what God does is not what we expect. Wisdom does not put us in a position of control. This is the focus of Ecclesiastes. The Hevel of life under the sun reminds us that the full sequence of what God is doing in life under the sun, from beginning to end, is beyond our understanding. And so what do? We focus on what we know, not on what we don't know. We mentioned that last time. We hold on to the promise. So how does this affect our pursuit of wisdom? How do we pursue wisdom rightly because of this reality? In both Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, Solomon encourages us to pursue wisdom as a means to flourish in God's world. But especially in Ecclesiastes, he cautions us not to think that wisdom will put us in a position of control. Okay? There's a famous example of people who thought wisdom put them in control. Okay? There were three of them. And they told their friend that if you do this, then God has to do this to you. Do you remember them? Job's three friends. Okay, he was suffering, obviously, because he sinned. And so, Job, if you want to get your wealth back, all you have to do is worship God, repent of your sin, and that will force God to give you back what you lost. Okay, wisdom does not put us in that kind of a position. Okay. Wisdom does not put us in a position of control. Ecclesiastes would have us pursue wisdom, but with our eyes wide open to the way the world really is, so that we might not be discouraged by the hevel of life and abandon the pursuit of wisdom altogether. Solomon would have us pursue wisdom because there are definite advantages. He listed those off for us, both in this life and hereafter, even though wisdom does not put us in a position of control. So the first characteristic of the God-fearing life is that it pursues after wisdom, not because it puts us in a position of control or I can manipulate God to give me what I want, but because God has commanded me to live in his world, his way, and he has given me this knowledge that I might flourish under his rule. That is why I pursue wisdom, but it is not to put myself in control. And so it is a humble, humble pursuit. Number two. To fear the Lord, what that life looks like. Number one is to pursue wisdom. Number two, this one may surprise you, it is to enjoy life. The one who fears God is the one who pursues enjoyment in life. Now, please hear me out on this, okay? I know maybe your mind's going to, this sounds like health and wealth, this sounds like something, please just bear with me, okay? To enjoy life rightly, we have to go through another tension together, okay? We must understand the tension between life's hevel and life's joy, okay? When we think about Ecclesiastes, we are quick to think of passages like this one where Solomon says, "So I hated life because what is done under the sun was grievous to me," verse 17. Verse 18, same chapter, "I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun." Same chapter, a few verses later. "So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun." And by themselves, these texts paint a very bleak picture of life, do they not? In fact, last week I mentioned that I actually think that Solomon, or the perspective of this book, is very much an optimistic one. And I had a couple of you say, "That I hadn't heard that before. That kind of threw me for a loop." And these texts certainly don't feel like someone who's optimistic, okay? So we read these texts where I hate life, and life is awful, and it's full of hevel, but then what else do we read? Go ahead and turn to chapter 2, verse 24. So we have all these very bleak texts paint a very negative picture of life under the sun. Chapter 2, verse 24. And I'm going to call these the joy texts, Ecclesiastes. Okay. He says, "There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind." Chapter 3, verse 12. He says, I perceived that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. Chapter 5, verse 18. Chapter 5, verse 18. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. Chapter 8, verse 15. Chapter 8, verse 15. He says, and I commend joy, for man has nothing better under the sun but to eat and drink and be joyful, for this will go with him in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him under the sun. So on the one hand, you have all these texts where Solomon says, I hate this life. And then he says, take joy in life under the sun. There's the tension. Okay, how does that work? How does that work? Solomon expresses his frustration over here. In other passages, he commands us to enjoy life. Could it be that Solomon, frustrated with life under the sun, is throwing up his hands and he's saying, life is hevel. It's one frustrating enigma after another, so just get whatever joy out of it you can. This is all there is. This is just hevel, so whatever you can get, get it. Okay. Taking this view, it seems, in my opinion, to turn Solomon into a reluctant worshiper at best, one who feared God in some sense because he has to. Okay. There's a better way to reconcile this tension, a way that rescues Ecclesiastes from being just an example of how not to think. Okay. That's what the book becomes when you take it that way. Ecclesiastes becomes a book of just, this is how not to live, how not to think. Okay. But I think there's a better way to understand the book. The other idea we want to get away from or get off the table is that Solomon is somehow saying, do whatever you want to. Do whatever makes you happy. Okay? We know that this is not the case either because of his emphasis elsewhere on future judgment. Sometimes in Ecclesiastes, a future judgment is a motivation to do what is right. Sometimes it is a comfort in the midst of hevel that God will someday judge rightly all things. Turn with me to Ecclesiastes 3, verse 17. 3 verse 17. I apologize for all the turning, but I want you to see this. He says, I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. Turn way over to Ecclesiastes chapter 9, chapter 11, verse 9. Chapter 11, verse 9. He says, rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart. Okay, that phrase right there. I mean, don't we hear that everywhere today? Let your heart be your guide. Ecclesiastes is picking up on that, right? Okay, whatever your heart tells you, that's what, right? He says, walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes, but, listen carefully, know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. And then a very famous text, chapter 12, verse 13, one that we all know from Ecclesiastes, very likely. Verse 13, the end of the matter, all has been heard, fear God and keep his commandments. For this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. And so as we look at these exhortations to enjoy life, we have to recognize right from the start that the joy in life that Solomon is commending to us is joy that lies inside the bounds of God-fearing behavior. Okay, this is not an excuse for license. This is not just a free-for-all. This is very much inside of what honors God and what will be judged rightly in the future, or as right in the future. So now I want to look more closely at a couple of these joy texts as we work through this and finish up today. If you want to turn back to chapter 3, verse 12, you can. He says there, I perceived that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. We read a second ago another one of these texts that said, behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun. And so very simply, from these two verses, we can establish quite strongly, as Solomon is saying quite strongly, we ought to find enjoyment in life under the sun. Okay? Is that how you think about your life? Should the believer enjoy life on earth? Or are we supposed to be so heavenly minded that we're no earthly good? It seems from this text that Solomon would have us enjoy, in some sense, enjoy this life. What does that mean? Turn over to chapter 2, verse 24 to 26. Again, very important text. Very important text. Down to verse 25 of chapter 2. Again, he says, "For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For the one who pleases God, or to the one who pleases God, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy." So after saying quite strongly that we ought to find enjoyment in life under the sun, Solomon explains that this enjoyment is the gift of God. You can't have this joy apart from God. It is God's gift, not to those who are apart from him, but to those who are with him, to those who are in covenant relationship with him. It is God's gift to his people. Okay? So this joy that Solomon says we ought to pursue, we ought to find in life under the sun, is a joy that is only found because God gives it to us. Okay? It's very important. Now, as you think through this, there are questions that arise. Maybe you're already thinking them, and I wrestled with these for a long time. When Solomon says, apart from him, who can have enjoyment? Does he mean that those who do not fear God cannot enjoy anything in life under the sun? You know, if questioned, would Solomon say an unbeliever cannot enjoy anything? Is the unbeliever incapable of even liking something? And the answer is no. Okay, that's not what he's saying. Obviously, there's some kind of enjoyment available to everyone, believing or unbelieving. If I go out to dinner with an unbeliever, both of us can like the meal. Okay, both of us can sit down and say, that was awesome. But according to Ecclesiastes, there is joy in life under the sun, which God gives only to those who please him, only to his people. And so, what is this joy that cannot be had apart from God? What is it? And I would say it is this. The joy that God gives only to his people is the joy that comes from knowing that life under the sun is God's gift. Okay, if you look all through these joy texts, over and over again, there's this idea that God has given life under the sun. It is his gift. It is man's lot. Okay? So think about it. Life under the sun comes with good things to enjoy. But those things in and of themselves offer only a temporary and brief enjoyment. For both the unbeliever and believer alike, the joy of a good meal lasts only so long. No matter how good the meal is, we're both going to be hungry again. Okay, in a couple hours. We're going to be rummaging through the fridge. Even though we're stuffed to the hilt at this point, that enjoyment is going to wear off. For the unbeliever, that brief joy is all there is. That's it. And then he or she moves on to the next meal. But for the believer, there is more to the joy of a good meal. Because the believer knows that this good meal is the gift of God. So how does this work? How does thinking about the good things in life under the sun as God's gift change the way I enjoy things? How does that work? Well, as the gift of God, my meal is more than just something that tastes good. It is a reminder of my relationship to God. What great joy to think that the food before me was put there by the one who created everything and in whose hand there is sovereignly orchestrated every time under the sun into a beautiful arrangement. As a gift from such a God, my meal is a reminder of his sustaining care for me as one of his people. What greater joy is there than that? As one author wrote, he said, "The joy is within the shepherding care. The joy is within the shepherding care of the sovereign, not in the vegetables and the wine themselves." And notice this, Solomon does not connect this joy with anything big. He doesn't say this joy comes with a big vacation, a new iPhone, or a better car. Okay? Of course, these things are not wrong and should likewise be considered God's gifts. But what does he connect this joy to? He connects it to our food, our drink, and our work. The most mundane, common things in life under the sun. Things we all do every day, which means that every day we have multiple opportunities built into our lives to stop and remind ourselves that our food, our drink, and our labor is a gift from God, and then to enjoy the reality that comes with that, that we are His people under His care. This has been a battle for me this week. Okay, we had some hevel in our lives with our car. My family was here, my parents were here, and their car can't carry all of us. So anytime we wanted to go somewhere, it had to be somewhere that going there twice to get everybody there didn't take that much time. Okay, and so, I mean, that is such a small hevel. I mean, it really is. Okay, but it was so frustrating. It really was. Bigger things this week. You know, I've told you before, we're in the process of trying to buy a house. And so we put a bid on a house this week, and we didn't get it. Okay? And that was hard. And so we've had to sit down before our meals and say, you know what? This is God's gift to me. And even though these things, this thing, that thing hasn't happened the way I thought it was going to happen, you know what? He cares for me. And He is a God who is all-powerful. He is sovereign over everything, every time. Even this thing that I look at and I think, how can that possibly fit into my life? It ought to be a circle, and I got a triangle. I can sit there and say, this God loves me. So, a couple implications of this joy discussion. I want to make sure you really understand what I'm saying, because it can be very easily misunderstood. If the unbeliever is limited to only temporary joy in life under the sun, but God's people enjoy both life's temporary joys and the God-given joy of being the recipients of His gifts, then believers ought to find more joy in life under the sun than anyone else. You ever think about that? If we have both the temporary joys of just the good taste of a meal, plus what that means for us in terms of God's care for us, I mean, we've got tons of joy, way more than anyone else. But let me be clear, this is again, not health and wealth. Jesus said we would have tribulation in this world. He called us to take up our cross and follow Him. I'm not saying that God's people will have more good things than unbelievers. But God's people can find more and better joy in what they have than can an unbeliever. Let me say that again, okay? I'm not saying that God's people will have more good things than unbelievers, okay? I mean, I look at all of us tonight. I mean, maybe you're sitting on a lot more than I know. That could very well be, but I know a lot of unbelievers that have a lot more than I do, okay? But God's people can find more and better joy in what they have than can an unbeliever if we receive it as God's gift. As one author said, far from a book of pessimism and fatalism, Ecclesiastes is a hopeful book that addresses head-on the realities of life in this age and does so in a way that nurtures hope for the next. Okay, let me read that again. I wish I could talk like this. He says, far from a book of pessimism or fatalism, Ecclesiastes is a book that addresses head-on the realities of life in this age and does so in a way that nurtures hope for the next. Now, very quickly, I'm supposed to be done. Ironically, this Thursday is Thanksgiving. And so the people of America will be very thankful. Sort of. Okay. But thankful to whom? That is the question that makes all the difference. The holidays and hevel are coming this week. Okay? Whether that's hevel in the holidays or just the hevel that God's prepared for you this week. I'd venture to say that probably all of us had hevel last week. We had no idea it was coming. Okay? And it's going to happen again this week. That's life under the sun. For some of us, we may have more hevel this week than ever before, and it may feel crushing to you. Hevel does not go away when you believe in Jesus. It does not go away. Certainly, it's good and necessary around the Thanksgiving table to discipline ourselves to express our thanks to others. That's a good thing to do. But in the midst of life's hevel, being thankful to others will do little to encourage us if we are not first thankful to God. Ecclesiastes would have us remember that the turkey or ham on our tables, the mashed potatoes and gravy, these are God's gifts, and in them we should see His shepherding care for us as His people. Let Thursday's meal and every other good thing in your life remind you that the one who created everything and whose hand sovereignly orchestrates every time in life under the sun into a beautiful arrangement, this is the God who cares for you. Let's pray.